Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this multimedia performance, as you will discover. But before we have it, let me remind you that if you need reminding, which I don't suppose you do, that John Kay is one of Britain's leading economists, certainly one of our most original. He's made important contributions in public finance and industrial organisation, but he's also been probably, certainly in the economic area, the most successful academic entrepreneur of the post-war period in Britain. He virtually founded the IFS, he then founded London Economics, and he then founded the Said School of Management at Oxford, which is a pretty good record. He's currently a private citizen, fellow of St. John's College, Oxford, visiting professor at the LSE, and a research associate of our Centre for Economic Performance here at LSE, which is one reason why he's giving this talk here. In fact, this is one of a series of talks called the Queen's Prize Lectures, which are celebrating the award of one of the Queen's Prizes in higher education to the Centre for Economic Performance. So that's my first advertising plug. My second and much more important is this, which you've already seen outside. This is a wonderful book which John has written and is just coming out. I've read it and I learned something on every page. I think it's a really fascinating book with, for many of us, new insights into how markets actually work, from flower markets to stock markets. And I suppose the motive is always the same, to show the power of the market force, but also the culture which is necessary to sustain it. And I believe that's what John is going to talk about in his multimedia performance. John.
Thanks, Richard. And this is the second of three lectures, and I'm going to insist on calling them lectures, whose somewhat ambitious purpose is to reveal some, at least, of the truth about markets. I began this particular venture last night in the magnificent great room of the Royal Society of Arts. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that venue, but if you've been there, you will know that the walls are surrounded by murals depicting the course of human knowledge, ending with the technological and organisational changes which accompanied Britain's Industrial Revolution. I thought there was no more appropriate venue in which to applaud the genius of markets before a business audience. What I told them last night was that the central attribute of the market economy was not the jingle of cash registers, but something which I called disciplined pluralism, the conjunction of free small-scale experiment with discipline that cuts off experiments when they fail. And I argue that through disciplined pluralism, rich modern states have created a co-evolution of organizational and technological change. It's disciplined pluralism that resolves the extraordinary paradox by which the unplanned spontaneous order of the market economy coordinates economic activity more effectively than any conscious attempt to achieve that coordination has actually managed to achieve. Next week, in the third and final lecture in this series, I'm going to talk about follies, and where could be more appropriate to talk about follies than that eternal home of lost causes, Oxford. That's where I'm going to end next Tuesday. But all of this is, as you will, I'm sure, have realized by now, if you hadn't before you came, a campaign to sell my book, The Truth About Markets. And when I started writing it, people warned me against putting the word markets in the title of the book. The reason they warned me of it was they feared it might be filed by bookshops and libraries, along with books of which there were quite a number 4 or 5 years ago, about how to become rich by sitting all day looking at Bloomberg television. And books of that kind. And it's still true that when we hear on the news about what is happening on the markets or in the markets, what we're being told about is what happened to the euro or the FTSE or the NASDAQ. But actually, most of what has really happened that day in the markets is what happened on Regent Street, in supermarkets. And in the book, it's with these markets that I'm mainly concerned. Still, in the third of these lectures, the one next week, I'm going to turn much more explicitly to financial markets, because that's where a high proportion of the follies of markets over the last decade or so has been generated. But tonight's lecture is essentially the centerpiece of my argument. What I'm going to talk about here is the limits of the market economy, and it seems to me if the great room of the Royal Society of Arts was the venue to talk about genius, the old theatre of the London School of Economics, with its analytic traditions, is the place to talk about limits. There's been no more interesting time to have been a business economist, I think, than the last 15 years. Genius, limits, and follies have all been displayed in remarkable proportions. Let's remember how. It's not even the only book to have been published on the broad political economy themes which I want to talk about this evening. In the aftermath of September 11th, there was frequent reference to two works which were two of the defining works of political commentary of the 1990s. In The End of History, Francis Fukuyama argued that a combination of liberal democracy and lightly regulated capitalism provided a model of social and economic organization appropriate, not just for the United States in the late 20th century, but one that was universal in time and space. Counterposed to Fukuyama's thesis was Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations. And Huntington argued that competition between states and ideologies, which had been the principal source of world conflict for hundreds of years, was being replaced by competition between alternative civilizations with very different views of the world. And on September 12, 2001, Huntington seemed to be having the better of the argument. Yet today, that end of history thesis is not only alive and well, but rampant, and rampant in a far cruder version than anything that was described in Fukuyama's rather nuanced prose. And what I'm going to try to do tonight is first to define and then to demolish the economic philosophy which has come to have a large influence on politics and policies in both America and Europe over the last decade. I don't want to engage in argument about what exactly is meant by the Washington Consensus, globalization, privatization, that sinister phrase structural reform to which international agencies seem to be so much attached, because different people seem to mean very different things by all of these phrases. I'm going to define for myself the set of propositions which I will respond to, and I'm going to call the model of the world which I will define and describe the American business model. So the triumphalism, which was expressed rather carefully by Fukuyama, the triumphalism that followed America's victory in the Cold War, was quite quickly overtaken by more assertive accounts from business people and from popular commentators. Walter Wriston, who was the former chief executive of Citicorp, wrote of the twilight of sovereignty. Wriston claimed that markets should and would undermine the traditional role of governments. And by the end of the 1990s, this diagnosis of subordination of government to market was shared by writers like Naomi Klein, who deplored it, as well as by people like Wriston, who applauded it, or people like Tom Friedman, the New York Times' regular correspondent on globalization, who simply commented week in, week out, indeed day in, day out, on its inevitability and irresistibility. People who believe in the ABM have had some uncomfortable experiences in the last 3 years, as I reminded you earlier. The collapse of Enron and of WorldCom in the United States, the collapse of Marconi and ICI in the UK, the farcical attempt by Jean-Marie Messier to use his position as head of a French water company to announce the end of the French exception and to reinvent himself as a Hollywood media mogul, complete with a glitzy Manhattan apartment and starlets on his arms. We've seen these things in the United States. We've also seen them in Britain and Germany. And this week, we've seen the humiliating acknowledgement by US merchant banks that their so-called research in the late 1990s was actually very little more than a craven attempt to attract investment banking business. We've also seen the way in which Europe's telecoms companies, all round Europe, in Britain, France, Germany, Spain, brought themselves to the edge of bankruptcy through their expenditures on overpriced acquisitions, licenses to launch new services for which they paid a great deal of money but have in fact turned out probably to be worth nothing at all, and investment in infrastructure that will not be needed for years, if not for decades. But despite all this, the American business model today plays the role in political economy that socialism enjoyed for so long. All political positions, even hostile ones, are defined by their relation to it. Globalization and privatization are the terms of everyday political economy debate, replacing those of capital and class. Through the 20th century, the vocabulary of politics was basically determined by the left. In the 21st century, the language of politics, certainly in the economic sphere, is very largely determined and defined by the right. For its adherents, the American business model meets these same psychological needs for simple universal explanations that Marxism offered to its devotees. The supporters of the ABM display the same ingenuity in attributing all problems to government that socialists employ in characterizing all issues in terms of class interests. In what is quite a bizarre reversal, the claims of economic determinism and historic inevitability, which were once the characteristic of the political left, are today being made by the political right. So what do I mean by the American business model? The claims which are being made from this kind of position are really claims of four kinds. The first is that self-interest rules. Self-regarding materialism governs our economic lives. The second is market fundamentalism. Markets should be allowed to operate freely, and attempts to regulate them, either by social action or political action, are almost always undesirable. Then there's the minimal state. The economic role of government should not extend much beyond the enforcement of contracts and of private property rights. Government should not itself provide goods and services, nor should it own productive assets. And finally, there's a requirement for low taxation. Taxation is needed to finance these basic functions of a minimal state, but beyond that, tax rates ought to be as low as possible, and in particular, the tax system should not attempt to bring about any explicit redistribution of income and wealth. The lecture I'm going to give this evening, I propose to respond to each of these elements of the American business model. I want to say, assert, that although self-interest is an economic motivation, it's not an overriding economic motivation. That successful business people are driven less by greed than by the desire to build up a business. That ordinary employees are motivated by money, certainly, but not only by money, but also by their own self-respect and by their concern for the esteem and respect for their peers. And without these motives of empire building, status, concern for self-esteem and self-worth, there would actually be rather few businesses and rather little cooperative work. I want to claim that markets operate within a social context and can't function outside that social context, and that that's why naive attempts to transplant institutions have failed. I want to argue that property rights are social constructs, not objective facts, and that success of a market economy depends in quite a complicated way on the sophistication of its institutions and on the nature as well as the existence of property rights. And I want to argue that unless there's widespread acceptance of the justice of the distribution of income and wealth, market institutions struggle to achieve legitimacy or to function effectively. And I want also to remind you of a group of problems which most economists regard as more technical issues, the group of problems which also raise fundamental problems for this simplistic description of the American business model. The claim that asymmetries of information are inevitable with complex products, that the production of knowledge and information itself poses difficulties within the framework of that model, that we need deliberate coordination in important aspects of economic life, from environmental management to technical standards, and that market economies can only function on the basis of more cooperation than rational, self-interested actors would actually undertake. And in next week's lecture, I want to examine another problem, the markets for risk and capital, which have to a large degree essentially become fora for professional gambling, and that the important risks of modern life, insofar as they're institutionally handled at all, are actually handled by social rather than market. So let me start with by spelling out the arguments put on behalf of the ABM, the American business model. Interestingly, for most of the people who advocate it in a disciplined, thoughtful way, the American business model is at least as much a moral as an economic imperative. Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom is probably the best written and certainly the best-selling description of the ABM, even though it's now something like 50 years old. Its title is Capitalism and Freedom. What Friedman argues there is that government action in economic matters is essentially an attack on liberty. It's an improper use of the coercive power of the state. Freedom of contract, he claims, requires a minimal state, and therefore market fundamentalism and low taxation are immediate corollaries. Now, some right-wing radicals go further than that. They claim that it's a mistake for us to deplore materialism, to regard selfishness as a vice. Greed is good, and nice guys finish last. The rambling but strident philosophy of Ayn Rand, which some of you may have come across, Alan Greenspan's former mentor, it proclaims the virtues of selfishness under a title which it gives objectiveness. People like that argue that concern for other people is an emotion which can properly be called on only to the extent that we feel it spontaneously. And it follows from that that private charity is essentially the only proper mechanism of redistribution, and any further claims by the community would infringe our autonomy. I've just been reading an attack in this kind of vein on the imposition of fines on Argos and its competitors for price fixing in children's toys. The argument is that the OFT's intervention in all of this is an improper freedom interference with freedom of contract. And there is no doubt it is an interference with freedom of contract. just as when we imprison highwaymen, we interfere with your freedom of choice between the ability to give up your money or your life. If we regard freedom of contract and freedom of choice as fundamental rights in social societies, if you find these arguments persuasive, then there's really nothing I can do or intend to do tonight to dissuade you. But it's not actually these moral arguments which have given the American business model its business following and its political power. The arguments which have given it that business following and its political power are arguments that it's only the American business model that can generate the continuing material prosperity that most of us are looking for. And from that perspective, the morality of the American business model is for most people a problem rather than a source of strength. Its more moderate supporters are actually willing to recognize that the kind of propositions which I put up there have something of a public relations problem. Some of you may have read a rather brilliantly written book by Jurgen and Stanislaw that describes the spread of privatization around the world. At the end, however, having lauded all of the spread of free markets, they conclude with some regret that few people would die with the words free markets on their lips. And one has to acknowledge, you know, that that is true. Tomorrow we will have to greet demonstrators against capitalism. You rarely encounter demonstrators for it. And given the kind of words that people have died with on their lips, words like Stalin, Heil Hitler, jihad, and so on, it's actually quite a problem there for the US business model. And yet the difference is clear, that the way Stalin or Hitler or bin Laden recruited followers was by demonizing other people. The American business model, in contrast, actually demonizes itself. What most of us dislike most about it is the unattractive account which it gives of our behavior. It requires us to applaud the very characteristics of human behavior which we're brought up to despise. There's something very odd about all that. And sympathetic but concerned admirers of the market economy have always struggled with it. Some of them have resolved it. Many of them resolve it today by a process in which the ethical issues that have puzzled great thinkers from Aristotle to the present day disappear in a kind of haze of confusion and goodwill. This is where you find the advocates of corporate social responsibility and well-meaning business people who claim that if only self-interest can be interpreted sufficiently widely, there can never be any conflict between self-interest and the public good. The most famous expression of that, of course, is when Charles Wilson asserted, it's quite interesting to look at what he did assert, "I used to think," note the past tense, "that what was good for our country was good for General Motors, and vice versa." Actually, history has mostly interpreted that remark as malign, but if you go over it carefully, I think it was simply naive. A more plausible argument, a more plausible way of reconciling this moral dilemma, is to claim that there's simply a dichotomy between economic life and public morality. The values that are appropriate to business are just different from the ones that are appropriate to and we use in our private lives. As Goethe observed 200 years ago at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, everything which is properly business we must keep carefully separate from life. That exactly mirrors Milton Friedman's claim that the social responsibility of business is to maximize its profits. And this position, that there's simply a disjunction between business morality and ordinary morality, is something that has appeal again for people both on the left and on the right. The dichotomy is acceptable to many business people because it puts very few restrictions on their behavior. It says you don't have to worry about these kind of issues. And of course, the corollary of the dichotomy, is the general contempt for business and the people who engage in it, which you find among most intellectuals who are not actually themselves involved in business. So these moral issues are difficult, but the primary objection which I'm going to raise tonight to the description of human behavior which you find in the American business model is not that its values are immoral, is that its values are not, in fact, the predominant values of economic life, that greed is a human characteristic, but it isn't, for most people, a dominant one. And that is our experience in a whole variety of ways. Production systems that were designed on purely instrumental lines proved in the end unsuccessful, even in the market economy's own terms. The piece rate systems of automobile manufacturers, for example, were abandoned because they destroyed social relationships in the workplace, they provoked endless negotiation and confrontation, and they established a working environment in which no one cared about the quality of the product that emerged. What was odd and peculiar was that at almost the very same time as it came to be widely realized that these kind of complex incentivization structures were actually destructive and produced dysfunctional behavior on the part of people on the shop floor, they were adopted in the boardroom, you know, with widespread and increasing enthusiasm. It's not very surprising that after 20 years of that, we've learned that the results in the boardroom are not actually very different to the results which were observed of introducing these kind of mechanisms on the shop floor. Now, the truth is, of real bosses, of people who build successful businesses, it is as true that greed is not a primary motivation as it is of the kind of people I've been describing. The truth is that building businesses demands talent and hard work, and therefore isn't attractive to the truly greedy. The greatest, probably, of all robber barons, Andrew Carnegie, said, the man who dies rich dies disgraced. Donald Trump, I actually got hold of Donald Trump's autobiography in the belief that there at least, you know, I would find an uncritical adherence to the idea that greed was the only virtue that mattered in life. It was a shock to open the very first page and discover that the very opening words of that book were, "I don't do it for the money, I do it to do it. Deals are my art form." And of course, the second or third richest man in the world, depending on where Microsoft and Oracle shares happened to be at the time, the legendary investor Warren Buffett, said, "It's not that I want money, it's the fun of making money and watching it grow." And of course, in Buffett's case, grow and grow and grow. But despite its growth, he still lives in the bungalow in Omaha, which he bought in 1956, and his favorite idea of a night out is still going down to the local Nebraskan steakhouse to wash down a large T-bone with a glass of cherry Coke. There are some people who are obsessed by greed and by money, and actually their natural home is not business, it's politics, because politics is the area of life which most easily rewards position rather than effort and talent. And actually, that was true of politics for most of the history of the world, and it's still true of politics in most of the world today. Government as kleptocracy is something that continues to ravage most poor countries. And one of the remarkable achievements, and actually one of the key elements in the rise of the market economy, has been the development of mechanisms in Western societies that have excluded these kind of individuals from politics. Mostly historically, they were also excluded from business as well by the observation which I've made that building successful businesses is something that rewards, that requires talent and hard work. But what we've done over the last two decades has been to say that greed is an acceptable, even admirable value in business. And it's all right, not just in entrepreneurs, but it's all right in the kind of people we hire to run large corporations. In every area of financial excess, greedy financiers have preyed on naive business people and gullible investors. What has been completely novel about the last 15 years or so has been the opportunity for salaried managers of large businesses to divert substantial fractions of corporate earnings to their own account. In Britain, although we have some grotesque remuneration packages, we have not yet reached the position which has been reached in the United States, where the amounts which are taken by the senior executives of corporations are actually large in relation to the profits and earnings of these corporations. But in the climate we have been creating, we're not necessarily too far away from doing that. And in this decade, concern for status, which was always a strong economic motivation, was translated into concern for money, because as never before, money was actually the measure of status. It may be surprising to those of you in this room who haven't met them, but many of the senior executives who pay themselves these large amounts of money are concerned to do so less because they like the money. They don't actually mind having the money very much. But it's less the money itself, actually. Very few of them have time to spend it. It's the money as measure of their position relative to the position of other people who are being paid equally large amounts of money in similar ways. Equally, the overriding aspiration of the decidedly unpleasant characters at Solomon Brothers, whom Michael Lewis described in Liar's Poker, was to be regarded by their peers as a big swinging dick. As Lewis describes it, what really stung the traders was not their absolute level of pay, but their pay in relation to other bond traders. Now, for 50 years, a paradigm of rationality in relation to all this has been the principal way in which economists have described economic behavior. It has to be said that what economists mean by rationality is by no means clear. Sometimes what they mean by rationality is self-interest. Sometimes rationality is simply consistency. And it's the practice of many economists, when they're attacked for using models of rational behavior, to switch from one to the other. It's a pretty common academic device. And I'm sure it's used in as many other subjects represented here as it is in economics. The traders at Solomon Brothers were undoubtedly people who were greedy and self-interested. But the essential feature of their behavior was that they behaved in the manner in which they were expected to behave in the environment in which they found themselves. You can't read these kind of accounts without being reminded of schoolboys behaving badly in a playground. And in part, that kind of behavior was because these kind of people found Solomon Brothers, and in part because Solomon Brothers went out to find these kind of people. But should we really be surprised then when we announce that greed is the dominant economic motivation, that we find that it's greedy people who flock to business? And should we be surprised that the outcome of that was a speculative bubble without precedent in world history and an outburst of fraud and misrepresentation? And what it's best to describe as simple theft on the part of many people who ran large companies. Now, none of this is to deny that self-interested materialism is an important part of economic life, and economic systems which rely on appeals to work for the common good will fail. They haven't been tried very much, but insofar as they have been tried, they have not proved successful. But self-interest in an effective market economy is necessarily hedged by the complex institutions of modern economic, social, political life: formal regulation and implicit rules, mechanisms of reputation and coordination, instincts and structures of cooperation, feelings of solidarity. Modern societies did not develop ethical norms of commercial behavior and personal behavior out of perverse desires to restrain entrepreneurial spirits. Real economic motivations are complex, multifaceted, not necessarily consistent. We ought to study human behavior as we economists, I'm now talking about, should study human behavior as an empirical subject rather than by imposing a model of the world on the world. And the best starting point, I think, is to assume that behavior will be adaptive, that people will behave in the way in which they're normally expected to in the circumstances in which they find themselves. And that kind of adaptive behavior is not the same as rational behavior, but it's not completely different either. A general instinct to cooperate with other cooperative people is not necessarily rational, but it is adaptive. And that expectation of adaptive behavior will sometimes be false. The occasional falsification of that expectation is actually very important to making market economies work and develop. So the motives which are implied by the economic American business model are a crass oversimplification of how market economies work. And concern about the moral values which are at the heart of the ABM are closely associated with doubts about the legitimacy of the distribution of income and wealth that results from it. Now, if these differences in income and wealth in society result from differences in talent, in effort, in productivity, interfering with that distribution may imply a high price in economic efficiency. And that leads directly to what I described as the fourth pillar of the American business model, that redistribution of income and wealth shouldn't extend much beyond the provision of a modest safety net. Yet it's very obvious, if we look round the world economy today, that differences in income and wealth are not, in fact, mainly explained by differences in effort, talent, skills. That there are many talented and hard-working people in poor countries whose economic circumstances are the result not of their own deficiencies, but of the deficiencies of the institutional structures within which they operate. These differentials in talent and effort also explain only a small part of the distribution of income within rich states. Are Bill Gates' effort, talents, and skills really so exceptional? Do they justify an income many thousands of times greater than, let's say, Alan Turing, who probably has the greatest claim actually to have invented the modern computer, and who never received more than an academic or civil service salary? And what of the big swinging dicks at Solomon's? They're valuable to their employers, which is why they've paid multi-million dollar bonuses, but the social value of their activities is small, if indeed it's positive at all. Corporate executives, as we've described, are paid a lot not because of their productivity, which is actually impossible to measure, but because of their position as gatekeepers and till managers. They take a slice of the economic rents that pass through their hands. So the complexity of the way in which market rewards are determined make it impossible to argue that that distribution of reward is necessarily either just or efficient. And as I've described, thoughtful conservatives like Milton Friedman don't actually make that claim. Their arguments are based on moral philosophy rather than economic pragmatism. What they assert instead is that interference with a process that gives rise to these rewards would be unjust because it would involve illegitimate state coercion. Now, some people might agree with that argument, but many wouldn't. And that disagreement is itself a problem, because if the distribution of income and wealth in the market economy doesn't secure general acceptance, then that distribution is going to be expensively disputed. Rich people dispute it in the courts, and poor people dispute it in the streets, and the costs of both litigation and crime are a serious burden on a modern market economy. And much worse still, in many Latin American countries and in modern Russia, basic questions about the nature, origin, legitimacy of property rights have led to corrupt, confrontational structures of politics which blocked effective economic development. So the American business model emphasizes the central importance of property as an institution, so central that its defense is actually the principal function of the state. But that's something that assumes that the nature of property rights is obvious. But they're not obvious. Property rights are socially constructed. Property rights can be defined in many ways. They can be allocated in many ways, among individuals, households, and firms in many ways. And the definition and allocation of property rights are the product of social and political mechanisms. Let's just look for a moment at the variety of property institutions we have for everyday commodities. We start every Economics 1 course by talking about simple exchanges that involve apples and pears, that even apples actually turn out to be much more complicated products when you look at it. You don't actually buy an apple anymore. You buy a Class 2 Granny Smith apple from Safeway. And all these components of the transaction, or components of the product, are really rather important to what it is you buy. It gets more complicated still when you buy a bottle of wine to go with your apple. In the case of the apple, you don't have to be Granny Smith in order to produce the Granny Smith apple, but actually if you buy a bottle of wine, you'll discover there's an appellation, and you'll discover there's a chateau on the name of the bottle, on the kinds of bottles some of us buy, there's a chateau on the name of the bottle, on the kinds of wines other people's buy, there's a brand on the name of the bottle, and there is the restrictions and rules that apply to each of these is more complicated. Then you have a season ticket to the London Underground. Well, you may think you haven't bought the London Underground. It's not even all that clear what that you've bought the right to any journey, far less a comfortable journey, on the London Underground. And you might think you've bought the ticket, but if you turn it over, you'll actually see on the back of it a very firm statement that says, this ticket is the property of London Underground Limited. And if you ask who is London Underground Limited, the answer is it turns out to be a body owned by the Secretary of State for Transport, who plans to transfer the ownership of his shares in it to yet another elected body. If you live in a flat, you will say you own your flat, but it turns out what you actually have is a lease of that flat, which is the English solution to the quite tricky problem of how you allow people to buy a bit of a house. And every Western jurisdiction has produced a different kind of answer to this problem of how you enable people to do that. And finally, you try and cope with all of this by means of a system on your computer, and I shan't describe the complexity of the licensing arrangements and regulation which are around the use of your computer, and particularly that affect your computer when you start to plug it in to any network or system. It's far too simple to talk about the organisation of a market economy in terms of property rights. We have very complicated rules and regulations, and the effectiveness of the economy depends on the quality of the institutions which we've created. Property rights, in short, are not obvious at all, and indeed the development of the market economy has been based on the construction of many different kinds of property rights. Now, to go back to Friedman, he, unlike many of his less sophisticated followers, actually understands that. In fact, in Capitalism and Freedom, he says that what constitutes property and what rights the ownership of property confers are complex social creations rather than self-evident propositions. But he then goes on to say, in many cases, the existence of a well-specified and generally accepted definition of property is far more important than just what the definition is. He doesn't actually produce any evidence for that proposition, and actually most experience of economic history and geography demonstrates the opposite. The invention of agriculture, of limited liability companies, key developments in the modern economy, represented an evolution from one form of property rights to another form of property rights. The wildly different economic histories of Argentina and Australia reflect the very different ways land rights were determined in countries of settlement. Basically, if you settle an empty country, you can determine property rights by that in two ways, from the top down by allocation from the centre, or from the bottom up by allocating them to the people who actually settle the land. Basically, in all these countries of settlement, both these systems existed, both came into conflict with each other, but the large difference between most of the English-speaking colonies and most of the Spanish-speaking colonies was that top-down allocation won in the Spanish colonies and bottom-up allocation won in the English-speaking countries. The result in Latin America was the confrontational structures of politics which have actually inhibited all forms of economic development within these countries for a century or more. It simply isn't true that the existence of a generally accepted definition of property is far more important than just what that definition is. You may think we will never face again the problem of allocating land in an empty country, but actually what one did with state-owned assets in Soviet Russia was actually a very similar problem to that. And 10 years ago, Anatoly Shubai, who led much of the Russian reform in that period, said, "They're stealing absolutely everything, and it is impossible to stop them. But let them steal and take their property. They will then become owners and decent administrators of the property." A statement that mirrors Friedman's very closely, but it actually wasn't true. They didn't become decent administrators of the property.
Everything they told us about communism was false. But everything they told us about capitalism was true.
economic failure of post-communist Russia is actually an enduring reproach to those people who claim that the only requirement of a modern economy, a modern market economy, is the firm establishment and enforcement of a system of private property rights. The key difference between rich and poor states in the world today is in the quality of their economic institutions. But there's much more to that difference than the amount of protection that's given to property rights. And this institutional perspective is all pervasive in understanding how the market economy really works. The deep-seated fundamental failure of the American business model I've been describing is that it does not recognize the fundamental complexity of the social institutions of the market economy and the degree to which economic institutions and organizations need to be embedded in the society, politics, culture of productive economies. And that embeddedness extends actually to every aspect of economic life. It's that embeddedness, the interlinking of economic and social institutions, that is the answer to that variety of issues that are typically characterized by professional economists as market failures. I want to say that what are market failures in these terms are typically market successes, because what has actually happened has been that the complicated market economy has derived solutions to deal with most of them. For example, information in complex modern economies is necessarily incomplete and imperfect. The famous device for illustrating this, used occasionally by Joe Stiglitz, who makes a profit out of it, I won't bother, but it starts when I try to offer you the amount of money that is my wallet, in my wallet. I know what's in it, and you don't. You can make a variety of bids based on speculations about what's in it. £30, £80, £10, £100. Well, I'm going to accept a couple of these bids, and I'm going to reject a couple of others. And you can probably guess now roughly how much there actually is in my wallet. There's £50, and that means I accept any bid that is above £50 and I reject any bid that's below. Trade takes place only by mistake. That is, the only exchanges which it's worthwhile your while to make are the ones which it's worthwhile my while to refuse, and vice versa. So trade only occurs on misunderstanding. And if that example seems artificial, and it is, it's artificial only because it focuses absolutely starkly on the nature of trade in an environment in which one side knows more about what is being sold than people know about what's being bought. And actually, that kind of exchange happens rather a lot in market economies. It happens when you buy a washing machine, and it also happens when you buy shares in a dot-com company, for example. And the interest of the example lies not just in its illustration of the problem, but in the way in which we immediately start to think of the variety of social mechanisms which we have in place to try and deal with these kind of problems. Trust relationships between buyers and sellers, intermediaries who validate information for us, product brands, the reputations of individuals and firms. Again, market failures don't often come about because of asymmetries of information. They come about when the social institutions that surround properly functioning trade don't exist or break down, as happened, for example, in the dot-com bubble. Equally, we need institutions to handle the risks we face in life.
Believe me, sir, had I ventures forth, the better part of my affections would be with my hopes abroad, and every object that might make me fear misfortune to my ventures out of doubt would make me sad.
I like that quote, because it's actually the clearest illustration I know of what it is that economists call risk aversion, the being made sad, as it were, by uncertainty about the outcome of our particular ventures. As you recall, Antonio was indeed made sad, but Antonio was also bailed out, essentially by the social and political institutions of Venice, the support of his friends and the creative interpretation of his contract by a sympathetic political court and ruler. If Antonio had actually lived a century or so later, he would have been able to benefit from the invention of marine insurance, which was one of the first markets in risk. And of course, after that, the growth of these markets exploded. But most of the explosive growth of these markets in the 20th century was not actually the growth of the primary markets in which merchant traders like Antonio placed their risks with other people. It was the growth of the secondary markets, resembling the wallet auction, in which people traded on these risks with each other in the belief that they knew more about or could better price the risks they were taking on than other people. So that marine insurance began to solve Antonio's problem. By the late 1980s, when the largest claim that had ever been made in the world of marine insurance happened, when Piper Alpha went on fire and collapsed in the North Sea, it turned out that the risk transfer that had been made was a risk transfer from Occidental Petroleum, the largest loser, who could perfectly well have borne the risk associated with that failure, to a group of individuals in the Lloyd's insurance market who had, without any understanding of what they were doing, insured that particular risk over and over again and discovered that it cascaded round the market, environment in which the total claims at Lloyd's relating to one single £1 billion loss amounted to an aggregate of £16 billion. So we today have active securities markets in which you can trade in all kinds of risks. Risks like the risk that the third quarter growth statistics will come in better than expected. You can also buy insurance against the risk that your bags will be stolen when you go on holiday. You can insure against the risk that Loch Na Gael will not come in first in the 5 o'clock race at Ascot. We have active risk markets in all these kind of securities. These are the risks you can trade, but they're not actually the principal risks of everyday life, which are risks of divorce and relationship breakdown, risks of redundancy and unemployment, risks of critical and long-term illness, risks which are, insofar as they're handled at all, handled not by markets, but by social institutions. For 50 years now, economists have been exercised by what has been called the prisoner's dilemma, the problem that self-interested individuals won't cooperate even when it's to their mutual advantage to do so. Economists have worried rather more about this than other people. One famous article in the literature is entitled "Economists Free Ride, Do Other People," which did an experiment on a group of students and discovered that they behaved in the manner in which rational behavior in the prisoner's dilemma predicted, perhaps because they'd been taught it, but students who hadn't received that particular education mostly didn't. But actually, once again, the interesting point is the way in which the world is full of social institutions designed to solve prisoners' dilemmas. Institutions with names like Honour Among Thieves, or institutions that are called policemen, teams of co-workers, ethical norms. Once again, the social context of economic behaviour makes it possible to have the kind of cooperation that modern economies need. Equally, there's a large economic literature on how market economies will produce too little knowledge and information because of the public good property of knowledge and information. These things are hard to keep to yourself, and the cost of disseminating them once created is very low. However, it doesn't seem to be the case that insufficient investment in knowledge and information is actually one of the major practical problems that modern economic societies have. When we looked this morning to see how many web pages we could get on Google, I think the number had gone up to three trillion web pages, etc. Once again, we have a whole variety of social institutions to handle the problem. We cross-subsidize the production of true information from the dissemination of false information through a device we call advertising. And when I asked myself the question, who paid for the major innovations of the 20th century, I took with friends a list that ran through things like relativity, television, computing, antibiotics, DNA, green revolution crops. I was quite surprised by the answer. The role of corporations was very small, which I'd expected. The role of government, it turned out, was also small. The role of intellectual property protection was negligible. Actually, the most important source of finance was private philanthropic funding. And the most important incentives to these kind of innovations were not, as it were, material rewards. The people who engaged in them neither expected nor, in almost all cases, got major material rewards. It was actually the thrill of discovery and the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. I could go on with these examples. You'll be relieved to hear I'm not going to. I hope I've made enough examples to demonstrate a general point, which is that these so-called market failures, which we talk about as economists, are actually failures of a model of the market economy. They are not failures of the market economy itself. And much of the strength of modern economic institutions comes from the social mechanisms which have evolved in order, which we've evolved in order to handle these institutions. That is, market economies function because and only because they're embedded in a social context. So let me try and sum up the policy implications which come from that particular embedding of the market economy. The American business model supposes that the market economy is defined and described by the day-to-day activities of greedy people endowed with vigorously defended property rights, but otherwise free of restriction or regulation. The truth is that self-interest is not the only or an overriding economic motivation, that market economies rely on and achieve far more cooperation than the ABM's description of behavior allows, that the most effective economic motivation actually is the natural desire that most people have to do a good job. The social context of transactions is almost always important. Brands, reputations, the relationships we build with institutions and colleagues. Most commercial agreements in reality are enforced not by contracts and legal processes, but by the need people have to go on doing business with each other. Risk markets, including securities markets, are typically fueled not by risk sharing and transfer of the kind that Antonio needed, but by over-optimism and different assessments of the same risk. The risks that really matter in modern societies are actually handled by social institutions. Disciplined pluralism is what I've described as the essential dynamic of the market economy, and the object of the reform of public services ought to be to try and introduce that disciplined pluralism into the market economy. What has happened in the last decade is we've been presented with an account of the market that is not only not true, but we've also been presented with an attempt to make the world conform to that particular model, which has been deeply damaging both to the effective functioning of that economy and to its political legitimacy. That is, by misunderstanding the nature of America's victory in the Cold War, the ideologues of the American business model actually undermined it. Yet there's one final question which I need to answer. It is the question, if the American business model is not a plausible description of how market economies function, then why is it that the American economy is so successful? And of course the answer to that ought by now to be fairly obvious. It is that the American business model does not in fact describe or the effective functioning parts of the American economy. Actually, as this is Tocqueville, understood over a century and a half ago when he wrote what is still an extraordinary work about the nature of newly emergent American society. The distinguishing feature of American society above all is what he called association, the creation of social and economic institutions that mediate between individuals and community. The most democratic society on earth is found to be the one in which men in our day have most perfected the art of pursuing the object of their common desires in common and have applied this new science to the most effect. And of course the most important of these institutions, the one that barely existed in Tocqueville's day, is actually the large American corporation. Corporate man, the epitome of America's submergence of the individual in the corporation, was once the butt of jokes, but it's actually corporate men and women who are the social individuals who make the US economy work. And what we, corporations not only in the United States, but here in the last decade, have suffered a great deal from is actually forgetting that. The reality of the success of the American economy is its base in cooperative institutions. And the paradox of the last two decades has been the way in which both the legitimacy and the efficiency of modern capitalism have been undermined by an account of how that capitalism works that is at the same time repulsive and false.
Well, John, thank you very much for the fascinating series of arguments. Who would like to start off? You, yeah. Have we got some mics? Yes. Thanks.
As one of John's former students, excellent, but he usually is. I wonder, however, why Adam Smith, a professor of moral philosophy, didn't get mentioned. I was waiting all the way through with bated breath, and I wonder if you can try and relate some of what you were saying to what he was saying 2,500 years ago, or possibly longer. I might also, because I am allowed to make a little criticism, you showed a picture of low taxation, and I think standing next to the picture of low taxation was Bill Gates. Now, Bill Gates Senior, I don't know whether I hope this is genetic as well, but Bill Gates Senior is one of the most outspoken advocates of the maintenance in America of inheritance taxes, which he sees as important, A, to help America pay its Social Security debts, B, because he sees the passing on of wealth within families as an inefficient allocation of capital. And he, Bill Gates Senior, certainly seems to share this view with another of the often regarded great demons of the last decade, George Soros, a man who also is frequently mentioned in this august institution.
Bernard, I hope it's right. I did once try to teach you the difference between a question and a speech, but I can see I never succeeded. I think I want to say much about the views of George Soros and Bill Gates Sr. on the structure of the American economy. I don't think they're advocates of what I described as the American business model. You know, the subject of the relationship between what I have to say and the works of Adam Smith would, I guess, be the subject of a rather lengthy book, and I have to say it's not a book I'm very keen to write. Let me simply pick up two, as it were, Smithian themes in this context. You know, one is what, to my mind, is Smith's central theme, which is the division of labor and its importance in creating the modern economy. And I think what we have learnt over the last 2.5 centuries is how much further that division of labor can go than anyone could have imagined. And essentially, if one wants one simple explanation of why most of us in this room are rich and why most people in most of the world are poor, it's that we participate in this extraordinarily finely graded and organized division of labor, whereas the vast majority of people in the world still basically produce most of what they make for their own use or for use within a very small community of which they're part. So that when people go out demonstrating against globalization tomorrow, there's part of what's behind their demonstration that they have got right, but in picking globalization as such as the object of their target, they've got things terribly wrong. The other thing, which you probably expected me to pick from Adam Smith, was, of course, the reference to the invisible hand. One thing which I learnt from Emma Rothschild in the past year, and I'm surprised how few people have picked up on, is the context in which Smith actually wrote about the invisible hand. And if you go back and look at that, what Smith was saying when he wrote about the invisible hand was that actually there wasn't the need, which most people at the time advocated, for protectionist tariffs, because British merchants would tend to buy British goods in any event. That is, the invisible hand would lead them to that kind of informal protectionism without any need for government action in order to take it.
I don't think it's useful for us today to spend enormous amounts of time speculating on what Smith meant by the invisible hand. I think there is very little basis for the adoption in the last couple of decades of Smith as a right-wing icon by the groups who have lauded him as a hero, but in fact have rarely seemed to have based that on any deep acquaintance with his works. Still, we had an embarrassing moment a few weeks ago in my office when someone rang from the Smith Institute and had to be asked, is that the John Smith Institute or the Adam Smith Institute? Since they represent the opposite poles of the think tank spectrum in Britain today.
Next question.
Can I ask you a little bit about market failure? You said that market failure is really failure of the economic model and not of the market itself. I mean, what about pollution? What about climate change? The government are consulting at the moment about the impact of aviation on the environment. Are they wasting their time? Are there social institutions that are already dealing with that?
No, they're not wasting their time. There are social institutions that are already dealing with that, and I expect we need more such institutions. But the recognition of the identification of these things as market failures is in relation to a perception that in general, you know, the outcomes of market processes are necessarily efficient. And when you understand some of the arguments which we've been running through about the socially constructed nature of property rights, you know, about the fundamental pervasiveness of asymmetric information, you understand what people who developed models of market efficiency, theoretical models of market efficiency in the 1950s, understood perfectly well, which is that at best, these are descriptions of conditions that would need to be satisfied for markets to have certain efficiency properties. They don't in any way demonstrate that the markets which we actually have are actually efficient. So when I talked last night about what I regarded as the genius of market institutions in creating an extraordinary pace of technological and organizational efficiency, innovation, in achieving higher levels and more effective coordination than planned and coordinated societies had done, I thought what I was trying to do was to describe facts. You know, right, I was not trying to say, and therefore these are good things and ought to be allowed to operate to their to the maximum extent. Some people might draw that conclusion from the argument, but you don't have to.
Oh, absolutely marvellous, fascinating stuff, and tremendous trepidation. I even try and think of a question which probably baffles me, and I hope doesn't baffle you. But you say, and it's very hard to deny, and I absolutely agree with, in fact, that the ABM is full. You say that greediness is not a good enough, sufficient working motive to make the ABM work. You say, indeed, also that a great many people, you cite a large number, are not motivated by greed, they're motivated by other values. And then you say, it seems to me like a slight sleight of hand, but tell me that I'm quite wrong, but you move on to saying other factors which will actually preserve, protect the ABM, modify it, so that it works well, a way in which we can applaud, not simply for its moral value, but actually because it's functional value. I'm a slight loss to see how you actually connect the values that actually drive a Bill Gates or a Buffett or whoever it is with the values that you believe are necessary to make the ABM work in a way which you cherish. And I'm not quite clear how you actually get the values that you believe are necessary into the system, and once they're, how you protect them and preserve them.
I think if I can say so, Christopher, some trepidation, there's an element of misunderstanding there of what it is I've tried to argue, and the key point I want to make in respect to that is to say that the American model, the American economy is not like the American business model, and therefore, right, and what the American business model is in fact a caricature of what is a wonderful and successful institution, which is the variety of market economies, you know, which we have around the world.
But
the mistake which we've made is to try and make the model, the world, like the caricature, and in so doing we make it worse.
John, I'm perfectly prepared to accept that. Where I find myself shuddering slightly, or not quite clear, is you've talked about people being driven by the joy of the job, the fascination of what they're doing, all sorts of motives. What I ask clear is that why those motives, any more than we, should actually, when in operation, protect the ABM, or the actual economist as well, from the sins that you characterize the ABM as having.
Well, I'm not sure they do. I merely observe the empirical fact that market economies, however they operate, have actually functioned successfully. And what I want to argue is that the explanation of how market economies function is actually very complex, and we only very partially understand it. It's the result of a complex process that has no conscious design about it, and has, as it were, been the process really of a co-evolution of technology and right and institutions. And it's because it's a complex structure which we only partly understand that almost all attempts to engage in large-scale reform of it, of whatever kind, have actually failed. So the problem with socialism was not that it was, as it were, the wrong grand design for reform. It's that any grand design for reform was bound to fail. One experiment which I've watched with, perhaps amusement is the wrong word, but a certain amount of amusement, over the last 15 years has been the New Zealand experiment, where that country has tried probably harder than any other country in the world, certainly harder than the United States, you know, to pursue the policy prescriptions of the American business model. And it has actually been the worst performing economy in the advanced world over the period from 1984 to 1999 when it implemented these reforms. The lesson for me for that is that large-scale interference with complex but reasonably well-functioning structures is almost always a mistake, whatever its nature or direction. It's a rather conservative, in a Burkean sense, kind of position, but it's one which I think experience of the world, you know, constantly refreshes belief in.
Yes, John, you pointed out that most of the major intellectual advances in the 20th century have been financed by private philanthropy rather than by state finance. And indeed, your own book is financed financed privately rather than by state funding. I wonder if you might want to draw any conclusions from this on how universities should be financed.
I think I know the conclusion you want drawn, Paul, and right, and I agree with it. I think the university story is extraordinary. The transformation of hegemony in the elite. Let's talk about the elite section of universities, which I think is what you have in mind. The transformation of hegemony in that sector across the 20th century from Europe to the United States, until by the end of the 20th century it's almost completely in the United States, is an extraordinary phenomenon. And the striking difference between the two continents is that in the US you have a pluralist structure of higher education with no central direction, one that conforms very well to my description of discipline pluralism, while Europe has seen the effective nationalization of its university systems, and the results are quite spectacular.
Is there a mic up there? Yes.
Okay, here are some questions. They're supposed to be food for thought. Okay, first up, why is it in my interest that you should own something? More generally, why is it in society's interest that particular people should own something, and what, if anything, does that tell us about how ownership should be distributed across society? On the subject of markets, have I got this right? Markets are systems of exchange. Does the fact that goods can be freely exchanged tell us anything about who actually owns those goods? Perhaps I could illustrate that with an example. One of the first jobs I got when I left school, one of the jobs I could choose from the rich banquet of opportunities spread before me was a job in a fast food store. On every Thursday, the management of that store would pin up the rota for the following week. That was a list of the shifts particular people had to work. Now, not everybody wanted to work the shift that was assigned to them, and they would exchange shifts amongst themselves. So you had, as it were, a market in shifts, and that market did everything a market should do. Relative prices were established. People didn't want to work on a Thursday.
Can you get to the...
Didn't want to work perhaps on a Friday or a Saturday. Okay, so a shift on, you could exchange a shift on a Friday or Saturday of 6 hours for a shift of 8 hours on the rest of the week. So prices were set, resources were efficiently allocated, but none of the people participating in that system of exchange owned the goods that were being exchanged. The goods being exchanged, the shifts, were actually owned by the management, who could and regularly did object to the contracts that the people working in the store had made with each other. I'll just throw that example out to you.
John.
I'm not entirely clear what the point to which that leads us is. I mean, I personally find the concept of property rights, which is very widely used by economists, alone in a very peculiar sense, which is not the same as the one in which property rights are used by legal and jurisprudential theorists. I personally don't find the concept of property rights very helpful. I think if what we regard as property rights in kind of everyday language, you know, are, as I've described, you know, social constructs, and indeed the people had in a sense, certainly in the sense in which economists talk about it, property rights in the shifts which you described in McDonald's, and they exchanged these property rights. You know, what you're describing is the rules by which a market economy functions. What I think you're inviting me to do is what some of the people who subscribe to the ABM, which I've described, do, but I certainly don't want to do, and I wouldn't encourage anyone else to do, which is to deduce from the fact that these things exist in a market economy that they enjoy some kind of moral legitimacy. You know, I hope there's nothing which I've said, which I've said today, which would contribute to that at all. And what I keep trying to say, I had this difficulty last night, although some people started to understand it, I can see bits of the difficulty again tonight, but really what I'm trying to do is to describe as a matter of fact, you know, how a market economy works. And it seems to be so unusual for people to do this that people find it very difficult to understand that this is what is being done. One can only talk about a market economy, it seems, in order to say it's a very good thing and ought to be extended as far as possible, or it's a very bad thing and ought to be controlled and regulated. And, you know, I don't want to take up either of these football team kind of positions. And actually, I think the only way any of us can ever understand how to make market economies work better is to start by understanding how market economies work. That has to come first, and that's what we in this sense, I include economists in, need to think about a lot more, instead of imposing prescriptive views of how it works, you know, on the world we find out there.
Last question.
I appreciate what you're saying, that perhaps some of the commentators in the United States particularly have overemphasized...
Can you make it short?
Yeah. Sorry?
Make it short.
Overemphasized the self-interest, the greed business, and not enough the important institutions and the complicated environment in a social way which supports achievements of the American economy. The question I want to ask you is a slightly different one. If we are being asked to say that the American economy has been very successful, I suppose they're saying that they have achieved a remarkably high level of growth over the last 20 years. Now, if we go back 50 years, however, the story changes. Up till about 1980, everybody was applauding the Japanese model, which was very different. And then we have slightly different models, very mixed models, which alone are adequate for explaining the success of some of the Southeast Asian economy.
I think we get the point.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are two parts to my answer. One is to say that we have, in, as it were, popular economic commentary, a mirror of the kind of boring fads and fashions of the business community, in which in the late 1980s, Japan was the model which everyone ought to adopt. Then the early 1990s, it was Germany. Then after reunification, people went off Germany a bit, and they turned to Singapore and Southeast Asia. Then they moved on from that to the United States, and it won't be very long before they move on to somewhere else. You know, this is just rather boring. And, you know, the central truth which we need to recognize is the success of the basic, the big question is the difference between the performance of the 20 or so rich states of the world, all of which are market economies, and all the rest which are not. And the differences between performance among the 20 are typically small and transitory relative to the performance of others. The second point is that there seems to have been some extraordinary brainwashing in the last 5 to 10 years into believing that there is some large and growing difference between the economic performance of the United States and the economic performance of Europe. I have to say there is in fact no evidence, you know, for such a difference. If you get a very large microscope and look at graphs under it, you can possibly see some evidence that the US did rather better in the second half of the 1990s. I think if you look at the figures rather carefully, I'm not sure even that conclusion stands up. The story is not that Europe is doing better than the United States. The story is not a reversal. The story is that there is no story to tell. You know, that there is some, that we have some manifest problem which requires urgent remedying by copying the United States is just not a proposition which gets beyond base one in terms of facts about what has actually been happening to the world economies. And I don't know why so many of us on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, seem to have come to believe it. Well, I think I do, but that's another story.
Yeah. Well, I think this has been an absolutely wonderful evening. I know you all agree with that, I can see. And we'll all go away with our new thoughts and perhaps even some new questions. I think I go away with a question rather similar to Christopher Foster's. One of the most striking things that you said was that people respond to the norms of the group to which they belong. Now, for economists, that's a terrific problem because it means that there can be all kinds of multiple equilibria. And it's difficult for economists to say actually where you're likely to end up, unless you have a proper theory of how norms are actually developed, which means that we actually can't answer these questions without some social psychologists to help us. And I hope they are doing reasonably well, or will do even better in future, to enable us to answer the questions that John has been grappling with. John, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful experience.
Can I just say in conclusion that first of all, most importantly, I hope you will buy the book and you have an opportunity to do so. But we'll also encourage you to do so with a drink upstairs for those of you who are able to join us.
Take the lift to the fifth floor.